Living next to the sea brings warm ocean breezes, sunshine, and expensive real estate. Much of our economy, from tourism to trade, relies on our proximity to the sea. But with billions of dollars of real estate here lying just inches above sea level, higher seas pose a significant threat to a key driver of our economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Coming up on the Sunshine Economy, Elevation Zero, rising seas in South Florida. Home flood insurance rates are rising as the federal government's program is billions of dollars in the red. Is the market sustainable? What role do architects, designers, and even banks play in the response to rising seas? It's the Sunshine Economy, rising seas in South Florida, and it's next on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Economy, Elevation Zero, rising seas in South Florida. Thanks for listening. The gentle breeze, the rolling surf, the sounds of the beach, where the land meets the water, easing into the waves, the sand sloping underwater. It's a tranquil scene, isn't it? Certainly one that we are particularly fond of here in South Florida. It is our in-town getaway. It's one of our biggest assets and the source of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in commerce. You'd probably have to pay close to $1 million, easily much more, to hear this from your home. But there's no shortage of people who are willing to fork over that kind of money, often in cash these days, to be able to call the waterfront home. In several decades' time, though, many scientists believe today's waterfront properties will be underwater, not just financially, literally. While the forecasts vary on how much and how fast the seas could rise, this much the science is clear on. The sea level surrounding much of southeast Florida has risen about 9 inches in the past century.
This is Robin Rorapaugh. I live at Hollywood, Florida. Sea level rise is happening. It's real. When I bought my house in 2000, we would have an occasional flooding experience. Today, when there is an easterly wind and a high tide and an inch of rain at the same time, my backyard's a pool. Last October, I lost my entire backyard to saltwater intrusion.
My name is Ned Skiff. I'm a landscape designer and contractor in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I've lived in this town for a lot of years, and if you drive during particularly the equinox period, say down Cordova Road in the Rio Vista neighborhood, the water levels are much higher there now than they were, say, 30, 40 years ago.
My name is Jim Miller. I'm a retired automotive and aircraft parts manufacturer, and I live in Pompano Beach. We see the symptoms and the increased flooding, not only in the lowland areas, but how long the flooding stays around.
Robin, Ned, and Jim, those three living in Broward County, seeing the seas change around their homes, around their neighborhoods. The threat puts billions of dollars of investment at risk, taxpayer investment, shareholder investment, but perhaps most critically, homeowners' investment. Plenty of local realtors will describe the South Florida housing market today as recharged. After the housing market collapsed about 6 years ago, sales and prices have been trending higher, especially those on the beach. Single-family home values are up almost 14% from where they were a year ago in August. And there's continued demand for waterfront properties like luxury homes on the beach to be able to hear this. But if you add the threat of rising sea levels to the real estate investment equation, are rooms with an ocean view and sound actually a terrible place to put your money long-term? The Miami Herald's Karen Runlett asks if property values will plunge as the seas rise.
The clock is ticking. You'll hear every expert who knows anything about rising sea levels say that. So it isn't just that it's a matter of time. It's a question of when. When will the waters be too high? In 87 years, which is the end of the century? Or in 10 years? Even though sea level rise can be described as a gradual emergency, with those timelines in mind, does that make a 30-year mortgage on a home in South Florida a foolish financial decision? Wayne Pathman can see the water from his home when he wakes up in the morning.
Well, I've been a resident of Miami Beach my entire life.
Pathman is a local land use attorney. He's been pretty outspoken about the need to start planning for rising sea levels. Pathman sees things in his neighborhood now that he doesn't remember seeing when he was younger.
I don't recall as a young child or a young adult ever having to worry about flooded areas that would flood even though it didn't rain.
That led to his work with the Miami Beach Chamber of Commerce. Pathman led a council that pushed the issue of rising sea levels. He also visited the Netherlands, a low-lying country with nearly 50% of its landmass below sea level. The housing market in the Netherlands would literally be underwater if not for aggressive flood control measures. Dutch engineers have a global reputation for their water management projects.
In the Netherlands, it's something that if they don't do it, they won't survive.
The Dutch have been working through their water challenges for about 800 years. They built dikes and levees. Dutch firms were even brought in to create a more thoughtful stormwater strategy for New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. During his trip, Pathman was impressed by both the cooperation and the commitment he saw from the private sector. Apparently, that's missing in South Florida.
Their concern for their sustainability for their communities is shared not only by the elected officials, but the business community and the residents as well. So they work together.
Pathman's no pessimist, though. He talks about solutions repeatedly. It's just that in South Florida, enough of the right people aren't working to find them yet.
How engaged would you say the business community is?
I think at this point there's very little participation from the business community because they're either not aware or there's no requirement for them to be there, and there's nothing that's changed in our codes or our construction patterns to require their involvement. And until they are engaged and understanding that this is an issue that's going to affect the entire community and their projects, I think that very little will happen or it'll happen a lot slower.
And more importantly, no one wants to kill the market with negative talk about one of the region's primary economic drivers, growth. Still, enough studies show that when it comes to real estate, the market, meaning buyers and sellers, neither is likely to respond to the crisis of rising sea levels until the final hour.
So in other words, if you would, the wolf is at the door.
Dr. Ken H. Johnson is a director at FIU's Real Estate School. He's a market specialist. Johnson compares it to the case of beach erosion. Studies on beach erosion show that property values don't begin to slide until catastrophe is imminent.
You would think that there would be some sort of a price discount, perceived cost that the marketplace would pick up on and you'd see a price change. However, this just isn't showing up until the water is right at the property's edge. That tells me the marketplace is not necessarily going to provide a mechanism to solve this, and perhaps we're going to need governmental intervention.
Back in Wayne Pathman's office, he pulls out booklets to show me architectural drawings.
So what you see here, this is what they call a water square. It's something being developed in Rotterdam.
Now we're looking at photos of homes in Rotterdam built on stilts.
Space. Look at the last picture here, and you see it's showing.
He said the Dutch feared no one would want to live in this particular planned community. Today, it's sold out. Whether or not your property will be here 30 years from now, in 2043, one thing is certain. The flooding has gotten worse. Ultimately, it may be the insurance issue that plays the larger role in influencing real estate prices.
The insurance industry will start dictating values as they start to measure the risk that they will be insuring against. Rates will climb, deductibles will be higher, insurance will be capped.
After all the payouts following Hurricane Sandy, the National Flood Insurance Program is in debt more than $20 billion. Last year, the price of insurance went up for folks living in known flood zones. But Pathman points to another possibility that would have more far-reaching effects.
And eventually, though, the insurance companies, who are also some of the biggest lenders for projects and development, will stop lending or stop insuring, which will have a downturn then on the market.
Eli Lehrer is the president of a think tank in Washington, D.C. that focuses on the insurance industry. He approaches the issue from a different perspective.
Storm surge is a larger and more imminent problem than is sea level rise. Sea level rise is projected to be somewhere between 2 and 5 feet over the next century. Storm surge is going to be 6 feet from a Category 1 hurricane, and the chances of a Category 1 hurricane hitting Florida are virtually 100%.
Even after a few quiet hurricane seasons in South Florida, we haven't forgotten their great force, most recently because of Hurricane Wilma and historically because of Hurricane Andrew.
It was the reverse. We reacted with good planning. We reacted with changes in our codes, especially our building codes, and we were able to recreate those communities that were hit the hardest by Andrew. and we spawn new development and new industries and new business. And I think the same can be done in dealing with rising tide.
Like the scientists, Wayne Pathman, the attorney, is watching the clock. He apologizes for having to leave me now. He needs to get to his next appointment. I'm Karen Rundlett, reporting for the Sunshine Economy.
In Southeast Asia, it's called Super Typhoon Haiyan, a storm that lashed the Philippines and Vietnam with wind and storm surge, leading some to call it the strongest storm to make landfall. Damage estimates and the death toll continue rising as rescue and relief aid from around the world is rushing to the region. The scenes are particularly poignant and powerful for those of us here. The storm may be 9,000 miles away from South Florida, but it serves as a forceful reminder of how quiet our recent storm seasons have been. Yet many homeowners have seen their flood insurance rates go up, shoot up exponentially in some cases. It's the result of the federal government trying to reduce the subsidies it provides for flood coverage, efforts that some on Capitol Hill are trying to slow down and even stop. Brian Earhart is the CEO of Aon Benfield Americas, a unit of the global reinsurance broker Aon. He says the climb of higher seas into your property would not be covered by traditional insurance.
The gradual rise in sea levels is really a maintenance issue, not an insurance issue, unless it's really combined with an insured event like a hurricane.
So a leaky hot water heater is a maintenance issue. A busted water pipe is a maintenance issue. But rising seas? A homeowner may need more than a monkey wrench and some Teflon tape to seal their home.
Well, it's sort of like if your home 15 years old and you had a new roof at the outset, of course, 15-year-old roof probably needs to be planned for putting a new roof on in another 15 years. Most roofs have like that 25 to 35-year life. So the replacement of a roof is not an insurance claim. It's a maintenance issue.
The threat of rising seas or a higher sea level becomes a maintenance issue for a residential property in terms of maintaining that property above elevation.
That's correct.
So enter the National Flood Insurance Program. It's entirely backed by the federal government. So when Katrina caused such devastation in 2005, followed by other storms, including Sandy last year, the program has been filling fast with red ink. Homeowners pay $3.5 billion in flood insurance premiums per year, but the program is $24 billion in the hole.
If the rise in sea levels are accurate, which everybody assumes that they are, then we're going to have areas that are going to flood repeatedly.
R. David Paulison was the chief administrator of FEMA, taking over after Hurricane Katrina. He's also the former fire chief of Miami-Dade County.
Right down here in South Florida, we had Miami Beach flooded 3 days in a row. With no rain, just from the tides coming in. So, that's unacceptable. We have to do something to fix the program and also do something with how we're going to deal with these rising seas.
And Paulison says there is one option for areas hit time after time after time by high waters. Move.
FEMA has actually moved entire towns out of flood-prone areas to higher ground areas. And then those areas they moved out of are now green space where no buildings are allowed to be constructed again. Maybe that's something we have to look at.
In 2012, Congress passed a law designed to reduce the federal government subsidies in flood insurance, bringing up rates. The Federal Emergency Management Agency administers the flood insurance program. As one agency brochure says about the changes, quote, "The new law encourages program financial stability by eliminating artificially low rates and discounts," end quote. So it was no secret the federal government underpriced flood insurance policies compared to the real risk of flood damage for many homeowners, especially those here in South Florida.
As the subsidies are trimmed back, you have a price that is much more interesting to a private insurer. And so they will begin to rate that product. Of course, our view that not every home is going to be insurable by the private sector, so the federal government, it's not clear that the federal government will ever be able to entirely get out of this program.
Now, the program dates back to the late 1960s when Congress approved it in part to actually reduce federal spending on disaster assistance and flood control. Critics now contend Congress is partly to blame for the terrible financial condition of the program by allowing building in ever-expanding flood zones. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Last year, the environmental community lauded a bipartisan group of lawmakers for passing a law cutting subsidies for flood insurance. They say those subsidies entice people to build where they shouldn't, in flood zones. Now a bipartisan group of lawmakers are trying to walk that law back. At a recent press conference at the U.S. Capitol, where new legislation was unveiled to keep those subsidies in place, Florida Senator Bill Nelson explained why he's putting his full weight behind the effort.
Ladies and gentlemen, 40% of all the flood policies are in my state.
Nelson and other bill sponsors say Congress acted too swiftly to end subsidies for federal flood insurance when they passed the Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012. That bill ends subsidies to more than 400,000 properties, mostly businesses and secondary homes. Cutting the subsidy has made those properties hard, if not impossible, to sell because insurance premiums are shooting up at unaffordable rates. Nelson says Congress passed a bad law.
It's time to act, and it's time to act now, and this will be retroactive. In the meantime, a lot of folks have lost a lot of sales.
Environmentalists see it quite differently. They say reinstating those flood insurance subsidies is the mistake.
It's a knee-jerk reaction.
That's Rob Moore, a climate change analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says federal policies have provided incentives for people to live in places that are now threatened by rising sea levels.
The price subsidies certainly make it easier for people to stay in areas that are prone to flooding.
Moore says the program was originally created in 1968 because private insurance companies didn't want to take on that risk. He says initially policymakers intended to use the program to slowly move people out of flood zones, but those good intentions soon gave way.
Well, the history of the National Flood Insurance Program has less to do with preventing floods and preventing the risk of flooding than prolonging.
Now with threats from nature on the rise because of global warming, Moore says Congress ought to be rethinking subsidies for flood insurance, not maintaining the status quo.
Well, if it didn't incentivize them moving into flood-prone areas, it certainly incentivized keeping people in flood-prone areas.
But lawmakers concerned about global warming see it differently. Louisiana Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu is one of the most outspoken voices calling for the subsidies to be kept in place.
This is not about encouraging people to live where they shouldn't. It's about providing an opportunity to live for people to live safely where they have to.
And one of the biggest proponents of climate change legislation, Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, says keeping the subsidies in place for now provides extra protection against nature.
These people are innocent victims of a change in our climate, a warming of the waters and our oceans, a change in the planet on which we live.
Markey says the federal government is merely offering a safety net.
The flood waters will continue to rise. But as the flood waters continue to rise and fear is instilled in people, they should not have their fear compounded by rising insurance rates that make it impossible for them to live in their homes or continue to operate their businesses.
Senator Nelson says sea level rise because of global warming is a different concern than this current effort to keep subsidies in place.
That doesn't affect the present situation, which is whether or not people can afford the sudden jump in premiums on federal flood insurance. You've got to make it phased in over time so people can afford it.
The legislation Nelson and the others are pushing requires FEMA to conduct a study on the nation's flood insurance policies. That effectively buys lawmakers 4 years to reassess the program. 4 years where the sea is expected to continue encroaching on land. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Join the conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Be sure to use that hashtag #ElevationZero. We've got more of a web chat as well at WLRN.org, including finding out your risk in your neighborhood, where you worship, where you go to school, where you work. Just look under the Environment tab for the Surging Seas Risk Finder. It's all at WLRN.org. Still to come, architects, zoning policies, and money. The role each of them plays in acknowledging the risk and response to rising seas when the Sunshine Economy Elevation Zero continues. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Economy, Elevation Zero, rising seas in South Florida. How at risk is your home? How at risk is South Florida real estate and the commerce that gets done in the name of real estate in South Florida? We're talking about it online at WLRN.org and on the air right here on the Sunshine Economy. Joining us now is Elizabeth Plater-Zybrick, the professor of architecture at the University of Miami, founder and principal of Duane Plater-Zybrick & Company. Steve Cohen, executive vice president of commercial real estate lending at Sabadell United Bank, and he's the past chair of the University of Florida's Bergstrom Center for Real Estate Studies Advisory Board. And Caroline Lewis, founder and executive director of the Clio Institute. All of you, welcome to the Sunshine Economy. Liz, is South Florida real estate doomed?
Good question, especially given the news that we're reading about this week. But it's a yes and no question. We're doomed if we don't do anything about things we know are going to happen so we can plan ahead. But we don't have to be. And there are many things that can be done, which some of which we still have to figure out.
So we there's certainly a lot of uncertainty out there, and we know here in South Florida, the level of uncertainty when it comes to pending natural disasters. We're familiar with the cone of uncertainty. We're also, to some degree, familiar with the vagaries of the forecast for rising seas, how much and when. Steve, is this getting a discussion on the financial side? Because the source of the dollars to build those developments and buy those multi-million dollar mortgages on the beachfront is a key source for behavior.
Tom, there is so much activity right now in the condo development market along our coastline. But frankly, I was here in August of 1992 when Andrew came through. You know, so even going back to your question, are we doomed? I don't know that we're doomed. I think we just have to be prepared. And I think that the developers today, the lenders today, the capital providers today are using the information that's available today. But we must continue to evolve and create new awareness of what may happen in the future.
Caroline Lewis with the Clio Institute. Lots of lessons were learned after that big disaster in August of 1992. Zoning rules were changed. Building regulations were changed. Are you seeing the pace of change keep up with the threat of rising seas?
I'd like to say yes, but absolutely not. I think that, unfortunately, so many of our elected leaders, the media and the public, have to be faced with the crisis to demand the kind of change, resilience, and response that we need now.
Steve, does the world of finance and the source of the mortgages need a crisis like that was experienced in late August of 92 to change and respond?
Well, it seems unfortunately like we always need some sort of crisis to create change. We just went through it with the residential mortgage business. There are changes that have been put into place, but that's more on a macro level. If you look specifically to South Florida, I've been very fortunate to always work with very strong banks that had long-term approaches to doing their business. It's about assessing risk, mitigating the risk, and then deploying capital in places where we believe we can have a high likelihood of success.
Success in terms of the return, not only of the capital, but on the capital, right?
Exactly. Most importantly, we are lenders, which means that we give the money out, but we also need it to come back in.
Liz, you work at the intersection between developers and financiers as an architect professor and as an architect yourself with a design firm. Are you seeing those kinds of smart long-term investments?
Well, you know, I'd like to pick up on the finance issue because we are accustomed to real estate being a forever asset. You buy it, it's an investment, you're going to sell it to the next person. And when you get a mortgage, everybody's depending on that next step. We have to develop some financial tools for those places because there will be places where we will say, we're not going to protect these places. We can't afford to, or the effects will just be too extreme. It's a kind of, I would imagine, and this is not my business, that it would be a sort of smoke and mirrors like the affordable housing tax credit, in which some return comes back to the private sector to say, here's a mortgage for the next 20 years or 30 years, but you're not going to get it back at the end of that. What you're doing is buying a tax credit by taking out that mortgage.
Your concern and your warning is there may be South Florida real estate that will be given up.
There will be shrinkage.
Steve?
Well, yes, there may be. But also, in the precursor to our discussion, you mentioned that Dutch engineers have done wonders at kind of holding back the forces of Mother Nature. You know, many of us wondered about New Orleans. Why would anybody develop in New Orleans below sea level? But I was there 2 weeks ago, and it's back, and it's alive, and it's vibrant.
Limestone.
And yes, there are levees that are there, but I believe that there will be future technologies, and I think that there's going to be a responsibility of our government and of our building officials to, you know, have that long-term approach, because the developers that I work with look at kind of the here and now, and they want to build something that's going to last, but they do it according to the current building codes.
And they do it, the return on investment that a real estate developer has is certainly shorter than the return on investment that a home buyer has. And Caroline Lewis, it may be even shorter than the return on investment that the broader community may have. So, you know, to Steve's optimism in terms of new technologies and new building codes, you don't seem necessarily so optimistic with the engagement currently of building officials and regulators. Talk to us a little bit about how they are approaching this issue, if at all, from the long term.
Well, you know, there's good news and bad news. And the good news is the four counties in Southeast Florida got together and formed this Southeast Florida Climate Compact. And for 5 years, they've been analyzing the data and coming up with mitigation and adaptation protocols. What I'm not happy with is how quickly we're acting on that knowledge, that information, those plans. And to me, people say we have to do something. And the we has three components, big components, the media, the public, and the elected officials. And I don't see the elected officials working towards climate literacy or sea level rise literacy so they can make informed decisions in the name of public service. They are elected to serve. They need to know how best to serve and put the funding and the policy where they need to be.
Caroline Lewis is the founder and executive director of the Clio Institute. Elizabeth Plater-Zybrick is the professor of architecture at the University of Miami and the founder of her own architecture firm. Steve Cohen, also along with us, executive vice president with commercial real estate lending at Sabadell United Bank. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Elevation zero, rising seas in South Florida. How concerned are you about your piece of South Florida real estate, if you have one? Be sure to send us a tweet at WLRN. Use the hashtag Elevation Zero or join that online conversation ongoing right now at WLRN.org. Liz, you work with projects across the region and across the nation. Are there places that you are seeing that are vulnerable to rising seas that are designing for rising seas?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that when you look at the map of the United States, and there are scientists who have mapped sea level rise everywhere within our boundaries, is that it's absolutely tiny compared to the landmass of the rest of the country. And therefore, national interest in this may be extremely limited, and that's why we have to take a regional initiative. But the one place I think that has done some work that we could learn from and probably should emulate is New York after Sandy, in which the Bloomberg administration produced a report. I think they put 40 people in a room for 6 weeks or some intense charrette to develop a series of actions and their cost and what the sources of funding might be over some period of time. It's a $20 billion plan. In some ways, they have a much more finite issue than we do, but it's certainly a model that we could use to get down to the brass tacks of saying, this is what we will do in some cases, this is what we will do in other cases, and really put together a plan.
Steve, what role do the financiers have in putting together that kind of response plan?
Tom, I think we've got a very important role, and I think we're definitely a big stakeholder in that initiative. I think one of the things that's a challenge, though, for our communities in South Florida, and we look at the flooding. I live in the downtown Miami area. Yes, there's flooding, but there's a lot more density there than there was when the original infrastructure went in. We live in a community with crumbling infrastructure in terms of water and sewer capacity. So that's a situation that, you know, is a here and now situation. And while we have to look into the future and plan for the future, we also have to take care of immediate needs. So it's a balancing act. The lending community has to be involved with it, but we all have to work together.
Find that balancing here, Caroline, because the comments that Steve makes, a lot of public officials will point to and say, see, Miami is finally becoming that 24/7 city. It's finally becoming the 24-hour global city with the development that you're seeing just south of the Miami River in Brickell, which you know, for those who know your Miami history, is where this little metropolis began so many years ago, certainly. So find that balance between the immediate needs of providing the infrastructure to support the development you see today and connecting that with the next generation.
Excellent question. Yeah, well, give me another hour and I'll have that.
It'll only take an hour?
No, but truly what you're asking is the question to be asked. And what we're looking for is sort of a synergy that South Florida, Miami-Dade, the Southeast region, could really say loudly, we get this, we care, we're going to fund the infrastructure needs right now that are the sewer repairs, etc., and we're going to do it right, and we're going to do it well, and we need a lot of funding help from outside of our region. Bring that ingenuity into this ground zero that we live in, to invest in what does it mean to be as resilient as possible in redoing infrastructure. The kids, I have a youth task force of college and high school kids. They get it. They want the government to act. People say we have to do something, but the we is what we don't define.
The resources may be more well-defined, and they're limited, Liz. I mean, the financial resources are certainly limited here. The capacity to put this kind of responsibility on the taxpayers is limited. We heard in the first part of the program, for instance, the real difficulties that the federal government is having and the pushback it's having, mostly from the state of Florida but elsewhere, to try to right-size premiums in the flood insurance program. So, you know, when we're just talking about a $24 billion problem, which is the flood insurance program nationally, how can we begin to address the multi-billions, if not trillions of dollars, that even are just located in Southeast Florida that's at risk?
Well, and so that $24 billion overhang is the crisis. Once again, we're at a point of crisis.
That's the emergency.
Yeah.
That's the debt on the part of the National Flood Insurance Program.
Yeah. And so we have to deal with that. I agree with some of the statements that were made earlier in the program about how you phase that in gradually, but I also think there are probably other finance issues to address. But it really is about planning ahead. It's about imagining scenarios in the future and planning for them. South Florida Water Management District, for instance, is planning ahead and changing the elevation of certain structures to deal with what they have seen happening already and what is coming. There is a new difficulty in the planning, though, which is that very often the public and the private sector need to coordinate their work in ways that they haven't been asked to do before. So if you're going to raise the land in some area that you wish to defend, the public sector might go ahead and do that. Raise Alton Road now that you are redoing it and putting pumps and other things in. But there's no scenario then for the private sector that's adjacent. What about the private properties that come along with this? All of that has to be considered together in a way that we never have before. So it's not just water management working by itself, which it can. But in the urban areas, you really need to get the public and private sector coordinated.
And Steve, to some degree, this gets to the time frame of the incentives on the lender side, on the investment side, that can be really the shortest of all the investment scenarios that we see when you look at the kind of response that may be necessary.
Tom, I excellent point. I think that when lenders look to lend on properties, and the area of the bank that I focus on is for those folks who use real estate to make money. It's the sale of real estate or it's the rental of real estate. When I look to give those folks a loan, I'm not looking at a perspective 50-year life of the asset. I'm looking at a much shorter term, a 20 to 25-year term. When someone buys a house, they typically get a 15 to 30-year mortgage.
Yeah.
You know, I think the studies have shown that by 2060, many of, or 2080, many folks think that the rise will be a foot high. I probably won't be here in 2080, but my kids and their kids will be here. So we do have to start focusing on it today.
You know, at the worst of times, real estate is seen as the greater fool theory. Find somebody who will pay more than I did for this piece of property. But at the best of times, it is buying at the appropriate time and selling high and being able to make a return on the investment that you made in terms of the capital, but also the time investment that you likely made. So, Steve, again, talk a little bit more about the time frame and the role of the financiers here? I mean, can you construct a scenario as we take the professor's guidance here and imagine ourselves in the future, different types of mortgages, for instance, that may or may not take into account a wasting asset that may waste away and spill into the ocean?
Absolutely. In fact, when we look at, let's say we're going to finance a drugstore. A drugstore is typically leased for 20 to 25 years. Now, there may be options beyond that, but all bets are off at the end of that period. So when we look to finance that asset, we know there's a stream of income for a finite period of time. Most of our developers and most real estate investors are looking for maybe a 10-year horizon to see what would their return of and on their investment be during that time frame. And if it hits those hurdles, they'll go ahead and make the investment. If we have as you called it, a wasting asset or asset that will be depleted at some point in time, the time frame is going to have to get shorter. The payback in the early years is going to have to be greater.
That's Steve Cohen, Executive Vice President, Commercial Real Estate Lending at Sabadell United Bank. Elizabeth Plater-Zybrick, Professor of Architecture at the University of Miami, and Caroline Lewis, Founder and Executive Director of the Clio Institute. Along with me, I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Economy, Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. The conversation on Twitter at WLRN with the hashtag Elevation Zero. Jose sent us this tweet. The immediate needed action is to change the building code. Long term is to mitigate the cause with expansion on atomic energy. Let's leave aside the carbon conversation for a moment here. And immediately, Professor, is building code key? Is it keeping pace with the science that's coming in?
Well, I'm sure there's more that can be done that has been done, but we have an excellent building code for many of the issues that we're speaking about, and indeed it's been tested.
You applaud the building code currently as it stands.
Yeah,
insurance applauded.
But this is a good question, Carolyn, because it brings up the insurance question, which very often may not recognize what an individual homeowner can make. So many people will actually do things that are even more demanding than the building code in order to protect themselves. After all, they have a deductible. We mentioned that earlier. But very often, the insurance companies will not recognize the single home or the single group of buildings that somehow are different than the neighborhood they're in. And so there are many issues to deal with the insurance industry.
But
isn't
the challenge with that, Professor, is water knows no boundaries. It's going to flow downhill.
Well,
the weakest link in the chain, if you may have a seawall that's 12 feet high, but if your neighbor's is 6, it's going to spill over.
But if you are on stilts, or if you have a house where you don't mind, as in Venice, that the water comes in several times a year and then you just muck it out because it's made of materials that don't mold, you know, there are many scenarios.
Adaptation.
The building code is one thing. There's how you decide to live in a specific place, building code or not. There are three ways that we can respond.
Mm-hmm.
One is we can defend a place,
mm-hmm.
And we will do that.
Reinforce.
Individuals may do that, but we need to decide citywide or region-wide whether there are any areas where we want to invest in doing that. You can accommodate. You can buy boots and make sure that the ground floor of the building is can be restored quickly, mm-hmm. without depending on your insurance company, and you can retreat, which we've already talked about, the shrinkage. So these are scenarios that are in front of us that we can in fact make decisions about.
When you take a look at South Florida and what's at risk, Professor, are there areas that you have been able to identify or even think anecdotally about as those that may have to be forgiven in the generations to come?
Well, you know, it's going to be an economic, a political economic question. And you're going to say, what is the most meaningful to us in terms of economic development and the GDP of the region? And everyone would say, well, the airports, the port, the tourist industry, that means the islands, our white-collar downtowns, and you'll start thinking about what to do for those.
Sure. There are power plants on the coastline.
Yeah.
There are a number of public infrastructures.
Things that you want to be around for a long time.
You're not leaving much room on the list.
The shopping center or the houses that are out let's say, out west, very low density water will be coming up there as well. That's where flooding will occur. It's not just along the coast. Generally speaking, affecting the economy minimally, those are the places that you might decide to give up, as you say.
Steve, how about it from a banker's perspective? You know, I know you're not a geologist or a climate scientist necessarily, but you're following the money and where it's being invested, certainly along the coastline in South Florida. Considerable sums of money here as the real estate market has improved. Are there conversations that need to be had at the closing table, at the negotiating table, about this investment in 15 or 20 years' time may wind up being forgiven?
We really haven't had to get into those types of conversations. Again, most of the loans that I'm engaged with are shorter-term loans.
Right.
It's easier to look at that horizon. However, we do employ third-party engineers. Whenever we're looking at a new construction lending opportunity, these engineers are the experts for the bankers. They're the ones that will make sure that not only are they is the building that's contemplated in compliance with building codes, but also they will suggest things that need enhancements that might be beyond what the minimum is required by code. So we do rely on experts, and we do it way before we actually get to the closing table.
Caroline, I had an interesting tweet here from Blanca Mesa, writing us at WLRN with the hashtag Elevation Zero. Should Miami set aside public waterfront land as conservation land? I'll ask it a little bit of a different way. Is there much land currently that's not privately held or being developed already that you know of that that could even be set aside that's in an appropriate area?
You know, people with far greater talent than I can answer that accurately. But I do know is this. It's not the economy or the environment. It's both. Bob Purchaseppe, Deputy Administrator of the EPA, made that point at our summit last week. And I think as soon as we can understand that, because Liz made a good point, economy is going to decide what we keep, what we invest in, and make as resilient as possible. But who's going to service these industries? Where do those people live? How do they get to work to make sure that your business is thriving and you're making the big bucks? Florida is making huge disinvestments in environment. South Florida Water Management District, some of the loveliest people are my colleagues.
You're saying they're making the wrong kinds of
investments.
They
are taking money away. They're not. They're unfunding the environmental arm, the environmental endangered lands, the things we need to work on saltwater intrusion and pumps.
We have seen some of the state money come back to Everglades restoration over the past few years.
It reminds me of the education. You take away $1 billion one year, and then you give it back to them and you're a hero. No, this South Florida Water Management District and the people working on deciding which lands should be bought as buffers and so on, they need the funding, and we're not funding them.
Finally, Steve, you mentioned earlier your great familiarity with downtown Miami. I just have to put it out there, since we're talking about real estate and rising sea level and the threat for the community, but also owners. To any of you, are you property owners? Are you buffeted against rising seas in the generation ahead? Professor, we'll start with you.
So, yes, I am a property owner. I have a property on the ridge, my house, a historic Coral Gables house, and we have an apartment in Miami Beach as well. And so we do talk about it and say, what about that apartment in Miami Beach? Should we? I believe that Miami Beach could protect itself from, because Miami Beach intrusion comes in from the west. It's not from the ocean.
The highest point of Miami Beach is the beach.
Is the beach. And that, by the way, is a long-term adaptation that's been going on already. So in terms of adapting to sea level rise or adapting to conditions outside of our control, we know how to do it.
Caroline, how about any adaptation in the Lewis household?
No, we're just sitting tight and hoping, because we don't have the money to do that. But we're on a ridge, and we're not in a flood zone right now, but, you know, we hope.
Steve Cohen, any special financial precautions you're taking against rising sea level?
Well, and I've got to confess, I came back to Miami a little less than 2 years ago after traveling the state. And right now I enjoy the view of the marina, the water, and the Venetian Causeway. So I haven't had to make any financial preparation other than make sure that my monthly rent payment's in on time.
Spoken like a true banker. Steve Cohen, Executive Vice President, Commercial Real Estate Lending at Sabadell Bank. Caroline Lewis, Founder and Executive Director at the Clio Institute. And Elizabeth Plater-Zybrick, Professor of Architecture at University of Miami and the founder and principal of her own architecture firm, talking about real estate here in the Sunshine Economy on Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. Still to come, buy low, sell low, how rising seas may impact those real estate values when the Sunshine Economy continues. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Economy, Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. So how high and when? Those are the central questions here for any property owner as the real estate market recovers, right? How high will the value of my property go and when will it be there? When will it be time to sell? But should homeowners, buyers, mortgage lenders, and others ask those same questions about rising sea levels? John Dorchner wrote about rising seas and falling real estate values in Sunday's Miami Herald. He joins us here on the Sunshine Economy. John, there is that real timing question here, not only in the forecast for rising seas, but let's face it, when it comes to this game we call real estate here in South Florida, it's a big timing question. What did you encounter in your reporting?
Well, several experts said that maybe within 10 and 20 years, there might be some impact on the market. A lot of it depends, and the uncertainty depends, that many experts believe that there will have to be some crisis, some humongous storm that wakes people up, because psychologically, events in the distant future don't hit us, while the event that hits us smack in the face wakes us up.
You've reported for a long time in this community. What has struck you about the level of engagement on rising seas, both in terms of the real estate industry, but also with public officials and homeowners?
Well, right now, everybody is in a wait-and-see mode as it comes to sea level rise. A number of environmentalists said that Miami-Dade in particular is slow to deal with this compared to Broward, Monroe, and Palm Beach. Mm. There's developers here have a very strong influence on the government, and so it's going to need everybody working together to do something.
We've been having an ongoing conversation online while we've been on the air on Twitter at WLRN with the hashtag Elevation Zero. Barbara tweeted us this, John, you'll appreciate it. Buy a house somewhere else. We haven't seen that kind of reaction here. Instead, we've seen money flood figuratively into the South Florida real estate market as it's recovered since the doldrums of 2008 and 2009.
One thing that people were sending me emails about when my article came out, starting now, when you buy a house here, you should at least know what the elevation is.
Right. You do have to sign off on an elevation. There's a truth in lending disclosure at any mortgage closing. There's a lead paint disclosure. All of these disclosures that a home purchaser needs to acknowledge before actually owning the piece of property.
Right. And where in the past people wouldn't have paid attention to their elevation because of the flood insurance and so on, now, especially with doubts about flood insurance, they should really know what their elevation is.
Do you think that would possibly have any impact, though, on the pace that we're seeing on real estate?
I don't think so. Not for the immediate future. I think the big event comes and then people wake up.
And we're saying this, of course, as our thoughts are with the folks in the Philippines dealing with that awful tragedy there. You can't be forecasting, obviously, any one particular storm, but we've heard it from a lot of corners about you respond to the disaster that you'd most recently experienced, and this one simply is just too slow moving.
Right. And the typhoon in the Philippines, perhaps that was due to global warming, but perhaps that was just due to weather trends. There's no way you can take one particular event and say that proves the trend. But the question is, will more of these be coming in the future?
John Dorchner is with the Miami Herald, and you can find a link to his article on our website at WLRN.org. Living here in South Florida, we do have a healthy respect for the power of water. From the slow but potent flow of the river of grass on the western border to the, at best, undulating and at worst, the devastating crash of ocean waves. This place we call home is a product of the ingenuity to engineer nature to make what's good even better. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening to the Sunshine Economy.
What good's a war without killing? What good is rain that falls up? What good's a disease that won't hurt you? Why no good? I guess no good at all. What good are these thoughts that I'm thinking? It must be better, huh, not to be thinking at all. A styrofoam lover with emotions of concrete. No, not much. Not much at all. Hey, baby, what's good? What's